Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Big Blue. I'm your host, Jordan Ron, on ESPN, ESPN.com, Giants reporter. And we're here taping this just a few days from the Super Bowl. So what we're going to do here is we're going to reminisce. We're going to turn back the clock a little bit and remember the 2007 and 11 Super Bowl. And we're going to go over it all with Matias Kiwanuka, former Giants linebacker, defensive end, defensive player, whatever you want to call him. Big part of the second team, was also on the first team as well, ended the season on injured reserve. But he'll tell us some good stories. I know you'll enjoy it. But first, let's talk about these current Giants. Let's get a couple things out of the way, right? There's a lot of talk around about going after Deshaun Watson, not just from the Giants' perspective, more just from a league-wide perspective. He wants out. The Texans don't really want to get rid of him. The question is, who would go after him? Who can get him? Blah, blah, blah. Let's get this out of the way real quick. The Giants are not getting Deshaun Watson. They're not trading for Deshaun Watson. It doesn't make sense for them. And I talk to people around the league, inside the organization. I'm telling you, Deshaun Watson, they're not going in that direction. That's not where this team is headed. This team is going forward right now with Daniel Jones. He's their guy. Daniel Jones is their guy. And look, you want to say, well, Deshaun Watson's a better player. He's proven. We know this. Deshaun Watson's a great, great, great player that the Houston Texans, by the way, don't want to trade. If you get him, he is uber expensive. So teams like the Jets, teams like the Dolphins, who have the second and third pick in the draft, huge assets, plus a ton of draft picks, they have, you know, some of the pieces that can get him. The Dolphins also have the team sort of built around him, where they then don't have to do a total rebuild. The Giants are in the middle of a rebuild. You want to look at it realistically, that's where they are. I mean, they're nowhere near talent-wise. We went over this last week, where they need to be in order to be a Super Bowl contender. They're miles from that right now, years from that, at least two, in my opinion. So they're not going to break the bank for the guy. And then how do they fill in the pieces around him? What's that defense going to look like? What's the protection and weapons going to look like? Like, it's not even realistic for this team. They don't have multiple first-round picks. They don't have an overload of draft capital. They have the 11th pick, too. So right there, you can basically take the Giants' first-round pick this year and first-round pick next year. 11 this year, and then whatever it is next year, future first-round pick. That alone pretty much equals the first-round pick this year alone for the Dolphins and Jets. So how are the Giants going to compete with teams like that in regards to if, and it's a big if, if I had a bet, I would still bet Deshaun Watson does not get traded and he ends up back in Houston. We'll see how much hardball he really wants to play when it comes to if he's willing to take money out of his pocket in order to push for a move. Okay? We'll see. But so the Giants, look, this isn't just my opinion anymore. This is confirmed. The Giants are not going to be in on Deshaun Watson or any quarterback. Daniel Jones is their guy. Book that. As far as internally, look, they're looking for an offensive line coach. We know that, right? Ben Wilkerson, he's going to be one of the guys that's interviewed. Mike Devlin, who is the offensive line coach for the Texans, he's going to be interviewed. There's some other candidates there. The Giants are looking to, I believe, get an experienced coach. So I doubt it'll be Wilkerson. Probably a guy that has a connection to Joe Judge as well. So look out for that. But that's sort of been his MO with hiring people so far. And in regards to the offense in general, Jason Garrett is going to stay. Again, I talked to people around the league. I talked to people inside the organization. Jason Garrett is going to be back this year. He's going to be the Giants offensive coordinator. Now, it's possible. We'll see what kind of changes are made internally. I think that's probably the likely solution at this point to fixing the offense. Maybe people internally getting more responsibility offensively. Their roles kind of changing a little bit. So look out for that. And by that, I mean guys like Jerry Schaplinski, the quarterback coach. I think Joe Judge looked to him and Freddie Kitchens when they were possibly short at offensive line coach because of COVID. Googe, who's not coming back, Dave DeGuglielmo, is not coming back. When he had COVID, those were the two guys that stepped up. And Jerry Schaplinski is a guy who Joe Judge obviously knows from New England, trust implicitly. Think he could possibly add responsibilities. Freddie Kitchens, a guy Joe Judge knows well, obviously was an offensive coordinator, head coach with the Browns. He could also add more responsibility, have more input, maybe into game planning, into coaching other parts of the offense. So Jason Garrett, and I know a lot of people did not like the way it went down this year. And I heard, look, there was times where there was tension there. And it wasn't so much, and Joe Judge, let's not beat around the bush here. Joe Judge is a very hands-on coach. That's kind of was Mark Colombo's complaint that on the offensive line and kind of why it blew up there. And this is why Joe Judge likes to have his own guys. They have to know that he's going to be hard on them. He's going to be hands-on. He's going to be looking over their shoulder. Like, that's how they're going to operate. That's how they think, and they that this will be the best operation. And so there was some tension between Joe Judge and Jason Garrett. I don't think anybody's going to deny that. And part of that is because the offense wasn't good. They weren't producing. But Garrett will be back. One of the benefits of that is, remember, they have a quarterback who already has been through two systems in 2 years, and the offensive players in general, you know, to have a little stability over there could serve a purpose. So in order to make that change, the situation had to be absolutely perfect. And that's not what happened here. So Jason Garrett returns. He will be the offensive coordinator in 2021 with potentially other people internally having more responsibility on offense in hope that the results are better. Because the Giants, I don't know where they finished. Did they finish 30th, 31st? I think in points they finished 31st. I think offensively, in terms of efficiency, I think they were actually 30th. I don't think they were actually 31st. But anyway, no matter how you cut that, it's not good. 30th, 31st, they both stink. So the offense wasn't good. And Jason Garrett's back. Hopefully year two is more successful with help from other people. Expect Joe Judge, obviously, to be heavily involved there as well, just like he is at pretty much every position. And the other thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to Super Bowl talk is Jeremy Pruitt. He's the new coach, defensive coach that was hired. Obviously, he has Alabama roots, so Joe Judge knows him from there. Like I said, you want to look at who the Giants are hiring to this coaching staff. Look if there's connections to Joe Judge, that he could have that trust in those guys that know how, you know, they're going to operate similar in a way, coaching-wise, I'm talking. You have to hold their coaches accountable, same way you hold the players, because if the coaches don't know what they're talking about, then the players won't know what they're talking about. So Jeremy Pruitt, a guy that Joe Judge, again, trusts, knows well, coached in somewhat of a similar system from what I understand throughout his career, so it's similar enough where he'll know what the Giants are trying to do defensively. He'll fill a role, it's not exactly title jet, but it'll be similar to what Brett Bielema did. Brett Bielema, I believe, was outside linebacker / senior defensive assistant. So Pruitt's going to be like a senior defensive assistant in a way. I'm not sure specifically if he's going to be involved with the outside linebackers. He's almost like a secondary defensive coordinator. He's going to float around, coach a bunch of positions. He's coached defensive backs, cornerbacks in the past, so he knows a lot about that. So the Giants aren't just going to pigeonhole him in outside linebackers. No, he's going to help on a grander scale than that. And like I said, also probably help scheme-wise be a voice, a sounding board for Patrick Graham on the defensive side of the ball. So almost like a secondary defensive coordinator. So that's where the Giants stand right now. We'll talk about draft coming up next week. I'll have Mel Kiper Jr., I believe, on to talk about the draft, the number 11 pick in particular for the Giants. So look out for that. That'll be like, we'll turn the page towards next season, the draft. We'll have a draft episode, then we'll follow that up with some sort of free agent episode, and we'll be moving. We'll be zooming. We'll be on our way. The offseason, where things can get fun here for the Giants, and really the NFL in general. It's going to be a crazy offseason. I don't think anybody really knows how it's going to unfold and what the guidelines are, really. This is going to be an offseason like no other. There are some factors with the COVID, the salary cap being all over the place, no one really even knowing what that is right now, which makes plans kind of impossible. So if anyone tells you they know for certain what a team is going to do, I find that hard to believe, because they don't know how much money they have. They don't know how much money they're going to have to spend. They don't know if they're going to have to shed contracts, how that's going to work. That's still up in the air. So we'll get to that in a couple weeks, I promise. In the meantime, let's talk about the Giants' last two Super Bowls. On to the next one.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
All right, it's Super Bowl week, so we have to talk Super Bowls. And who better to bring in than Matthias Kiwanuka, who has rings from the 2007 and 11 season. So he's not one of these guys that was, you know, made one of the two Super Bowls. No, he was on there for both of them. So how's it going, Matthias? How's everything with you?
It's good. Thanks for the introduction. I mean, more, I also got injuries from both of those years too. So I got
tomato, tomato. Nobody needs to know. Nobody needs to know that you were on injury reserve for the first one, do they?
No, we'll keep that between us.
Do you have the ring? Do you have the ring?
I do.
Exactly. So what do you mean? What are you talking about? There's nothing. You earned it for sure. But you, that's actually interesting now, because does the second one mean that, like, is that one much more special to you? Like, is the first one have the same meaning to you, being that, I think, would you go on injured reserve? You got injured in somewhere like around midseason, right? And this was like,
yeah,
you were a young guy at that point. It was first or second year, I think, right?
It was my second year. I started the first 10 games. It was the first year I was playing linebacker, and we were in Detroit. So I think that was week 10, somewhere around there. Somewhere around halfway point. But to answer your question, yes, the second one does mean more, I think, for a lot of reasons. One, I was there physically out on the field. Two, I was playing in Indianapolis where I grew up. So, like, getting to go back to the hometown and play in front of those, like, that was great.
Jerome Bettis come home to Detroit and win your Super Bowl in your hometown story. I gotcha.
Yeah. You know, I wore my Cathedral High School T-shirt out for pregame, and it was a great experience, football wise, and it was towards the latter end of my career. And you know, it was something that was really special, unique to be able to go through that process, knowing what was coming ahead, and having an understanding of what it takes to get there, and watching all those guys come together and believe. There were only a few of us left by that point, and they were you know, trying to gather as much information from us as they possibly could. And they really believed in what we were telling them, which was, you know, basically the same way we won the first one.
Right. I believe, I think Prince once told me, or a bunch of people told me, like, Eli gave a speech before you left, right? Mm-hmm. Something of the sort. And he stood up there and said, you know, you tell me, do you remember that? Do you remember anything from that? It was like his message to you guys before you went down there.
I mean, I don't want to paraphrase, but I mean, he only gave like maybe 3 or 4 speeches while I was there. So it's hard to forget. I was there for 9 years. So we talked. Like, he's a good guy to like to talk to and have conversations with. And he's humble. He's down to earth and all that kind of stuff. But getting up and talking in front of the group, that just wasn't his thing. You know, he'd more sit down at lunch and have a group of people and get the communication done that way. But so now I don't remember specifically what he was talking about, but I'm pretty sure everybody was paying attention. I'm sure I was at the time, but you know, I got hit in the head a lot. So
I think I'm paraphrasing also, and I think with the message, it was just sort of like, look, we're going down there for, you know, to get something accomplished. Just make sure you handle what you are, and then we will, the fun you'll be able to have after it, we'll make up for the fun that maybe you don't get to have in the next couple of days or whatever. Something along those lines. Real quick, if I remember right, was the gist of it. So, and like you said, Eli did not stand up very often, give many speeches, which is why I think it stood out to a couple of the young guys.
So. I do remember there being a sentiment around the room where, you know, some people were more focused on the hoopla, you know, as opposed to just getting everything done, getting in the training room early, staying late, watching all the film. I do remember that, you know, because the stories that were told you know, prior to us getting to the playoffs and all this and that, like, you know, the guys who had been there for maybe 1 or 2 years, the stories they heard were all the glamorous stories, you know, like we were, right. we were doing that. This is what happened afterwards, but they don't realize, you know, that first one, we started off 0-2 and you know,
oh, you got crushed too, right? Defensively.
You want to hear a story? When we finished that season, my rookie year, almost the entire coaching staff believed that they were going to be fired. They thought they were going to be let go. And we lined up, all the coaches lined up and shook hands and were just saying, you know, thank you for everything, you know, good luck. And me, like as a young guy, I just thought that was just
like walking off the plank kind of deal. That's what it sounds like, man.
Well, at first, that's what I thought. I was like, you know, at first I thought, you know, this is just how every season in the NFL ends. You know,
right.
On a turnover. But then, you know, after a couple of years went by, I looked back and I was like, oh, they thought they were out of here, you know? And you know, lo and behold, we came back. Majority of the staff came back and we won it that next year, and careers were made off of that. I mean, guys are still coaching in high positions because of what they did during that year. So, you know, definitely very proud to be a part of both of those teams, but the first one sticks out for different reasons.
Yeah. So where were you for the first Super Bowl? You said you weren't on the field. So where were you? What was that like?
I was there on the sidelines with Jeremy Shockey and, who else was it? Derek Ward. So Jeremy Shockey, Derek Ward, and I all had the same ankle injury, you know, fibula. And we were...
You fly down separately from the team also?
Yes. And that's...
Because that's like the famous thing with Shockey, right? That he didn't get to travel with the team, but it didn't... That wasn't just him, so I guess that's the funny part, about it. In retrospect,
it wasn't, and you know, they did try to make things right initially. I mean, we definitely didn't fly down with the team, and that sticks out because you don't realize how many guys on these NFL teams have children under the age of 5. I mean, that plane was a zoo. I got 2 kids that are 6 and 8 right now. So I get it now. I understand and I can tune it out. But back then when I was a young guy and I thought I was going down to party and all this and that, and I saw all the kids on there, I was like, whoa.
But that's like your worst nightmare. You know, like when you get on a plane and you got the crying kid next to you and the kid behind you kicking your seat. Like, yeah, that's like when you get the bad lottery ticket. That's a tough plane ride, man.
I got to be careful now. Some of these kids are old enough to kick my butt. They're big enough. that was a long time ago. So
True.
There were some issues with that. And then, you know, they had finally put us in the team hotel. There were some complications, some things. So looking back on it, I understand the reasoning behind it, but you got to remember, like at that point, like that was the trip that was going to make some people's careers, you know, like, yeah, we were injured, but we still wanted to feel like we're part of it. And it's just part of the culture in the NFL to, you know, to isolate the guys who are injured for a number of reasons, in my opinion. But, you know, you tend to feel a little bit marginalized and unappreciated, you know, when you're not out there. And some of that is just psychological. Some of that has nothing to do with what they're doing in-house. They could try and do everything the right way or everything that they wanted to do to help you out. But like as a player, if you're not on the field, you're doing something wrong, whether you're hurt or not. If you're not out there contributing, whether it's because of your performance or because of an injury, you're just in your mind or in my mind, I was doing something wrong. Something wasn't right. And I just wanted to correct it. So, you know, going back, having that opportunity to be out there in the second one, I mean, that's a gift that doesn't always come around. And I had to thank all those guys who put in all that time and that effort, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that must have been like a totally different experience. And just like sort of like a weight off your chest, you know, like, hey, I missed the other one. Thank God I didn't get, you know, I got that second opportunity, which to be frank, I mean, a lot of guys go through their career, they have zero opportunities, right? I mean, so guys struggle to make the playoffs.
The point I was going to make. We had guys stand up and say, hey, guys, like, I've been playing in this league over a decade. I've never made it out of the first round of the playoffs. Like you don't understand, like, how crucial it is. Like, you know, we were...
Did you understand, like, the Matthias Kiwanuka, like, 22, 23 years old that first time? Did you understand that, or did it still
resonate? No, the first time, absolutely not. There's no way to get that... to have that understanding until you're a little bit later on in your career. You know, all those speeches, I remember Big Bob Whitfield giving a speech. I remember the second time Antro Roll gave a speech. Like, you know, these are guys who were, you know, a little bit older both times that we won. And you could just see it, you could feel it, and their voices and, you know, their inflection and everything, like they really meant it. And, you know, it wasn't until I got towards the end of my career where I realized how special it was, because it's not about retiring from the NFL or not having, you know, another opportunity to be in the big game all the time. I think the thing that stays with you the most, or with me, is that, you know, I had a football season or some kind of sports season every year from the early 90s, you know, until right. 2015. So it's not, yeah, you miss the guys, you miss the locker room, you miss, you know, like a lot of the different aspects about it, but like it's part of your identity, you know, that's a big part of who you are. So making that transition is difficult. And, you know, when you're older in your career, I think everybody kind of starts to see the writing on the wall. So having that kind of an opportunity late in your career, man, you cherish it. You appreciate every moment of it, taking pictures, all that stuff, you know, it's a special experience.
The first one, let's go over the game. The first one with you, you're on the sideline. That's a legendary Patriots team at that time, right? I mean, even today, I mean, they went undefeated, for God's sakes, and they were stacked all over the place. What did you see from that? You know, your defensive front, you know, the front seven between the linebackers and the defensive line in that Super Bowl. What do you remember? Obviously, loaded group, right? You got Strahan, you got a young Tuck, you got OC, you got Antonio Pierce, right, leading the linebacking group. I mean, that's a big time group. What do you remember? And they played a huge game, obviously. Mm-hmm. What do you remember from that?
So at that time, I'll spend the majority of the time in the linebacker meeting room. So my, you know,
that's the hard part with you. You always got to wonder, when were you in the linebackers? When were you with the defensive line? Like, it depends on the year and the coach or whatever.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
It was definitely back and forth. I just did Dave Deal's show yesterday morning, and we were talking about, you know, he played every position up front except for, you know, and I was on the other side. I played every position. I started every position except for middle linebacker at some point during my career. So I would go back and forth. You know, I'd be in the linebacker meeting room for the majority of the week. And then on pass rush days and, you know, third down days, I'd be in the D-line meeting room. My routine was I would, you know, after everybody left, you did your workouts, you know, the coaches go upstairs and they get the script for practice for the next day. I would go home. And then I would come back in the evening to pick up that script for the linebacker so I could go over that, you know, prior to getting there in the morning, because I had to split time in different meeting rooms. So there was a lot during that first run. What I do remember is the guys that I was, you know, playing beside and next to: Reggie Torbor, Antonio Pierce, and Kavika Mitchell. Kavika Mitchell came in, learned the defense within, I don't know, weeks. And that was incredible to me.
Good player, Kavika Pittman, by the way.
Great player.
Mitchell, sorry.
Great player. He's a good player. He had an understanding of the defense and what we were trying to do. He was on the same page with Antonio Pierce and Reggie Torbor, and they had good communication with you know, guy who's still doing it at a high level, Spagnuolo.
Yeah. For sure.
That was my core group of guys that I was, you know, lined up next to and in the meeting rooms with. But, you know, every third down day, I'd go down and sit in the defensive line meeting room, and we'd, you know, do all the drills and all that kind of stuff. I just remember, you know, how much, you know, fun we had, but there was a lot of attention to detail. You know, there wasn't, and it was organic. It was stuff that we had been doing the entire year. You know, everybody was running to the ball during practice. We were holding each other accountable to run to the ball multiple times a day in practice, and running to the ball meant we had to see you straining. I mean, we got to see your head's got to be back. You got to be like really stretching to try to run the ball down. It had to be over, I want to say, like 30 yards at a time. Otherwise, you were getting fined. And that's not something we started or that, you know, that
you would get fined, like the internal, like a kangaroo court type deal.
Yeah. You had to plead your case and everything. And
who was the judge?
It was, I think it was OC, to be honest with you. I think maybe OC was one of the judges back then. Yeah, you got to ask him. I can't remember who exactly. But a positive note to that fine money at the end of the year went to a charitable cause. So we did something productive with it. But But yeah, so those things were, you know, accountability and fun, you know, hold each other accountable, but go out there and have fun, enjoy doing it. Had we not made it all the way, we still would have enjoyed that year and we'd still be in contact as friends, the same way we are right now, because we enjoyed what we did, man. We had fun.
Crazy to think about it. I mean, that quarterback is still playing, you know, that you guys went against both times, really. I mean, I was just thinking that for a second, like Tom Brady. So he was like, what, in his like 6th year as a starter or whatever time, dude's still playing, which is crazy. Yeah. I mean, think about the guys we just named. All these guys are long retired. This dude's still playing and making the Super Bowl. This is pretty.
The dude, he doesn't get hit. He doesn't get hit. Sure. You know, and that
well, he did in that Super Bowl and both Super Bowls actually.
He did, but I'm not saying it like, oh, he's lucky or it's by design. He doesn't get hit because he understands what the defenses are trying to do and he knows how to get the ball away. You know, Drew Brees is one of those guys. Peyton Manning, Aaron Rodgers is one of those guys. But I think combined, you know, they, or individually, they all took or take more hits than Brady does. You know, we got to the Super Bowl. And we put on a clip of all the quarterback sacks, pressures, and knockdowns from that season. And as the season goes on, you know, you're watching a specific quarterback, and that those plays, you know, that film gets a little longer, a little longer, a little longer each week as, you know, more plays get added to it for whoever we're playing. And we got to Brady, and it was the shortest clip we had all year. where did this guy get hit? Like, where did he, I mean, if you got up to use the
that bathroom, team was loaded, though. I mean, they were good everywhere. That 07 team that they had was really something offensively. The 11 team was good too, but I mean that 07 team was really unbelievable off the, just like everywhere, top to bottom.
Absolutely. I mean, they had a few holes, and which holes they did, they filled very well, effectively, and you couldn't really, you couldn't anticipate, you know, who was going to make a mistake. You had to force somebody into making a mistake in that game. You know, some games, you know, there's a guy, you know, there's a guy, hey guys, you know, we're going to watch this guy. He's going to give us the ball, or he's going to miss a call, or tip off the defense to what it is they're doing. There wasn't a whole lot of that. It was more about, hey, when the mistake gets made, you better be ready to capitalize on it. Like that was the mindset.
So, all right. That we went over the 07 one a little bit. Now you get to 11, right? You guys, what were you, 7-7 going into week 16, I think, right? So you won the final two. You got the Victor Cruz 99-yard touchdown or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't good.
Yeah. How surprised were you that team was able to put it together? Like, did you ever sense that was even in the realm of possibilities throughout the, you know, as you're going along there?
You know, every year after we won that first one, there was that underlying mindset of, until we are statistically eliminated, we still have an opportunity to win it. And we were able to get guys on that same page. I think, you know, once you get into a groove, or once you start seeing individuals have tremendous success, then you know, it becomes a little easier to see, or for everybody to have that same vision. But it really wasn't that difficult, you know, to get everybody on the same page and to sit around, and because everybody wanted to hear the stories. That's what we talked about the majority of the time after practice, before practice, when we weren't talking about, you know, what was going on that day, that week. It was, you know, how did you guys win? Like, what did you guys do? The same questions you're asking me. Those are the questions I fielded in the locker room, you know, for years.
So, well, you know, that's what we do. That's my business. We just recycle questions. And
or you ask the same question different ways until you get the answer that you want.
That's exactly. It's like poking the bear. You take the little stick. In the stomach. Come on, let's go.
That's my favorite is the, wouldn't you say that? And it's like, at the end of that, I don't even know what you're about to say, but I'm just going to answer that I want to. Don't you feel, or don't you believe that? No.
Oh, yeah, that's called a loaded question. Absolutely.
Let me stop you right there.
Okay, you get to the playoffs. Take me through that playoff run. I mean, the Green Bay game, and then obviously the Super Bowl again. You're facing the Patriots. What are you guys thinking at that point? First, take me through the playoffs. That San Francisco team was loaded too, right? I mean, that was I think that was Eli's best game that I've ever seen him play.
It's definitely up there. I think the playoff run, the thing that stands out for me, Jaquan Williams. There were a number of guys who were
Jaquan Williams
to do some incredible things. But
I think he was a rookie, wasn't he? In that year,
I can't remember. Was he that young?
I think he was a rookie in that season. Yeah.
I mean,
if I remember right. He was definitely young at that point.
He was a guy lining up in the box covering the deep third. Like he could move. He was not a linebacker. He was not a strong safety.
He was a little small linebacker.
Yeah. He was small. He was in between, you know, what you would consider a safety and a linebacker size, but he could hit. I mean, he could
yeah, run. 11 was his rookie year.
Yeah. And he had injuries too. He had a groin injury, had something else, but the plays that he made specifically in that San Francisco game stick out to me because that was a guy all year long who was in my ear, you know, what about this? What about that? Like, what are we doing here? What and I saw a maturation and a growth in him as an individual that for me as a player, like as an older player, it was like, oh, wow. Like, you know what I mean? Like you feel a sense of pride when, you know, people, younger guys in your group are doing well. That was, you know, we had a lot of young guys who stepped up during that playoff run. So that's kind of what sticks out in my mind the most. Individual games, it was cold. I remember how cold it was. And, you know, we had a lot of, you know, you always try to be a tough guy. You go out there.
You grew up in Indianapolis. Come on.
I live in Florida now for a reason. So I've been trying to get south my entire life. You know, I grew up in Indianapolis, went to Boston College, and then ended up in New York. And I said, you know, when I get a chance to pick, I'm coming down. I'm sitting here drinking a hot coffee right now, and it's 65 degrees, and I think it's cold. So that tells you where I was. But no. So yeah, the thing that sticks out the most was the maturation of the younger guys, them being able to buy in and to come in and do what was asked. So we asked people to do some ridiculous stuff. I mean, people see JPP out there right now dropping into coverage and intercepting. How he has 2 picks on the season this year.
Yeah,
I mean,
which is incredible, especially given his story, man. That guy is something.
It's unbelievable. And I think a lot of that, you know, started when we were with the Giants. You know, a lot of that understanding of, you know, this is just what you do. You know, the Patriots had a number of guys. And I remember... who was it? Was it Brian Flores? I think he may have been the one who told me. He's like, the expectation is for the position, not for the player. So we expect this position to perform at this level. And if you can do it, you do it. If you can't, you can't. And that's, you know, that's that was something that I think, you know, was brought around to the Giants around that time too. And you can still see it, you know, lingering, you know, in these players who are still playing, like JPP.
Yeah, well, it's JPP, man. What was that like? I mean, you're one of the mentors. JPP comes in. He's a different cat. He's not in a bad way. Like he's his own guy. You know, like he beats to his own drum in a way. What was that like for you guys? I know Justin Tuck over the years, he always used to laugh at some of the things he used to have to tell JPP. So he comes in right that year. He's a beast, obviously. What was that like for you guys to work with him? And to, you know, try and mold him and get him to, you know, buy into the ways of, you know, Tom Coughlin and that, those Giants teams.
It wasn't difficult to get him to buy in. The difficult part was getting him caught up, getting him up to speed. Now, he obviously had the ability, he still has the ability to learn and to understand it, but he had a limited amount of football experience coming into the NFL. He's right. A physical specimen. He still is. He, you know, probably will always be. He does push himself. He works hard. He's, you know, he's not one of those guys who just, you know, happenstance is good at football. He really works his ass off to be good. He's one of those guys. But he came in very limited in his knowledge. He sat right next to me in the meeting room, in the back of the meeting room. And, you know, he'd pick my brain. He'd ask me questions and whatnot. But we were a group. You know, when I left the room to go to the linebacker room and I came back and asked him, hey, what did we go over? What happened? Da, da, da. Like he had an answer for me. So we, you know, he helped me out a lot, even as a younger guy back then. But yeah, it was there were some basic fundamentals to football, not necessarily playing as much as the terminology, the language, you know, what technique is what, you know, those kind of things that he had to up on it. Yeah, the stories are hilarious. I'm not about putting people's business out there, but let's just say he started off you know, from the, not the basics, but he started off from a point where he needed a lot of assistance. But you know, he quickly took off. You know, his physical gifts and his ability to learn and his desire to be the best. I mean, you can't do it at that level for so long if you're not 100% focused on what it is you're supposed to be doing. And he's one of those guys. And he's a good dude. He's an all-around good guy.
Yeah, he is.
I watched the interview he did just last week or this week. And he's
yeah, your boy OC's dominating the stage, man. I know you're not surprised by that.
Not at all. That's OC though. You know, he's always, there's no moment too big for OC, you know, but
that's why he was running the kangaroo court. You know that. Come on. He's not the guy who's going to sit in the back of that, you know.
No. You can't ask him. You cannot lead from the back. You got to lead from the front.
Exactly. So take me through what you remember from that 07 Super Bowl. You start off, you get the safety on Tom. I mean, the 11 Super Bowl, sorry. You get the safety on Brady. You guys really, you know, gave him hell that game.
Yeah, it was the same concept. You know, we just need to hit him. You know, that was the
base. Came in there. That was the goal.
What's that?
Easier said than done, right?
Yeah. That's all we need. You know, just you know, throw a jersey on you, get out there. Nah, it was really about fundamentals and hitting the quarterback. Hits are cumulative. I can't remember which coach said that to me first, but you know, you have to understand that during the course of the game, if you hit somebody enough, it's going to alter what it is they're trying to do as well as how well they can do it. So, you know, we wanted to go into that game, you know, with that same mindset of just hit him, you know, hit him. Who? Him. him. Who's in front of you? Hit him. Like that's who you're hitting, you know? And I think we did that, you know, and we were fortunate enough to play under a staff that had, you know, they spent an unbelievable amount of time in that film room. There were X's and O's drawn up on every scrap of paper in that building. And everybody understood the different permutations of what could happen. And when you have that kind of knowledge on the sidelines and you go out there and you play well and you execute, that's, you know, good things happen.
Yeah. Good things did happen. You guys obviously win again. Justin Tuck, man, both those Super Bowls, totally almost like underrated, like, cause he didn't get the MVP, right? Wait, would you say that again?
MVP caliber play.
Yeah.
You know, he
could have won the MVP, seriously, realistically, if it didn't go to the quarterback every single time in both those games.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I don't know that he was necessarily a snub just because there was tremendous play on the other side of the ball. I know it always usually goes to the, you know, to the quarterback, but let's be honest. There's a reason why the quarterback touches the ball every single play. Like that is a very important position. And as he goes, so go the Giants, you know? So, I understand that, but from a defensive player, from team D line, from team linebacker, that man played his heart out. And if they'd have given it to him, we all would have been, you know, happy cheering him on. So, you know, that's you know, characteristic of how much work, time, and effort, you know, everybody put in, especially him.
Yeah, I mean, look, it wasn't just Michael Boley had 10 tackles in that game. Kenny Phillips.
Michael Boley, that's another one.
Yeah.
That's another great name. That's a good friend of mine, too. That's a guy who has a tremendous understanding of defense in general. I used to say, like, if you're not coaching when you get out of here, like, you're going to be wasting some, you know, a lot of talent just because he had a true feel and understanding of the game within the game. You know, he could prior to the snap. Him and Antonio Pierce were on that same vein. They could tell you prior to the snap, you know, what to expect, and you could believe them. You could trust them. They weren't just saying, oh, it's a screen and draw down. Like, okay, everybody knows to scream out screen and draw. I'm talking about when Antonio Pierce or Mike Boley tap you on your hip and they say, hey, take that B gap. You don't ask any questions. You take the B gap and you get a sack. That's
right.
What it is. You know, he saw something, I trusted him and I'll take it. We'll go to the sidelines. And if we didn't get the play, why did you do that?
Ironic part is they had such trouble filling that spot after that for like an extended period of time, the team, you know, from like, you know, the 12-13 season on. That was actually a big void for a while. Like they were shuffling guys in and out, you know, and then John Beeson came in for a year or two, and it was just
so they
finally seem to have got it right now with Blake Martinez. But yeah, that was it's an underrated position on those Giants teams. You always had that veteran guy filled.
It's very underrated. If you're the quarterback of the defense, you're asked to make calls and make checks. I think the relationship between a defensive coordinator and his signal caller or his middle linebacker, that is of tremendous importance. And I don't think enough people put that level of importance on it. Spagnuolo has been able to recreate success for a number of reasons, you know, and one of those is his ability to understand, his ability to communicate, and to convey information. Anybody can get up and talk, you know, and a lot of people have the knowledge of football. Anybody can get up in front of a meeting room and start spitting off statistics and put you, you know, tell you where you're supposed to be on what play. It's a different, it takes a different type of person to be able to convey the right information to everybody in a way that they can receive it and understand it, you know. And, you know, Spags was able to do that with Antonio Pierce, with Michael Boley, with Deion Grant, like all the guys who played and called the signals while I was there. And you know, we appreciated it.
So where are those rings now? Where are they at? You have them in a safe? Do you wear them? Do you ever pull it out?
The first one's in a safe deposit box. The other one I keep with me in my safe, and that's the one that I bring out. So if you see me with the ring, it's usually, or it almost always is, the 11 ring.
Which is understandable. I mean, I think most people can get that from you.
I saw Snee at a BC function. He had both rings on. I just remember thinking, like, wow, like that's what it looks like. But like, you know, he worked for it. He earned it. For me, it's like, you know, if you have a Super Bowl ring on, it doesn't matter where you are. It's going to attract enough attention, you know?
Yeah. I think I told the story recently. I was, my buddy was out and he's like, I bumped into Stephen Baker from the, you know, the older Giants teams, the previous Super Bowl team. And I'm like, oh, how did you know, Stephen Baker's not a big guy. He was a smaller receiver. So I'm like, oh, how did you notice it was Stephen Baker? Like, you recognize what Stephen Baker's face looks like these days? And he's like, no. He was wearing the ring. When a guy walks around in the ring, you know, that's not a normal ring. You know, guys just walk around with rings like that. Like, you know, if he played high school football or whatever. So he's and we figured out right away it was Stephen Baker. So yeah, you wear that thing. You're asking for people to come up to you and say, wow, hey, can I take a picture with you in the ring or whatever?
Yeah. Now I like to bring it, you know, when I'm going to talk to kids, not kids, but like young adults, like teenagers, like that kind of thing, because.
Oh, for sure.
That gets their attention. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, who's this old guy? Oh, he's coming here trying to tell us about, you know, working hard, eating right. Yeah. You show them that ring. It's like, oh. Yeah.
It's a plot at the end of the rainbow, right? Okay. You do it. Here's what you can get.
Exactly. So it's a motivational thing for me.
All right. So let's wrap it up. We'll play a little game here, right? We'll call it Call to the Hall, because these are, they're basically Hall of Famers, right? Because they're Hall of Famers somewhere. Tom Coughlin, Eli Manning, Justin Tuck. I'm sure they're all in some sort of Hall of Fame. Eli will be in the real Hall of Fame at some point, pro football. And I'm sure Tom Coughlin's in the Syracuse Hall of Fame, should be a candidate for the Pro Football Hall of Fame too. And Justin Tuck, Ring of Honor guy. So, these three guys, right? Keep three of the key pieces on those Super Bowl teams you were on, both of them. So if you had to pick a business partner between the three, TC, Eli, or Tuck, who are you going with?
It depends. What's my goal? Am I trying to make as much money as I possibly can? Am I trying to enjoy the process or what? Because
you're in charge. You're in charge. You have to pick. You have to weigh those options. What's most important to you?
I'm gonna go with Tuck. To be honest with you, he's very smart.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he went to Notre Dame. I went to Boston College. Yada yada yada. But whatever. But no, I think that he would bring enough to the table, knowledge wise. He would also keep it fun and keep it light. It's hard. It was hard to go with him over Coughlin, because if you're with Coughlin, you know you're gonna get it.
You're gonna be successful.
Going to be successful, or the sky is gonna fall on your head. Like, you know, and it's something that I appreciate in business. People who just get up, they get their stuff done. There's no complaining, and there's full accountability day in, day out. That's the kind of structure that breeds success. So I'd still take Tuck, but Coughlin's a good good one. I didn't spend enough time personally with Eli to judge, you know, so I'm leaving him out. But you know, not because of any other reason other than I was right.
Yep. All right, so you got to make a call to the Hall of Famers. You need a fiery speech. You go TC, Eli, or Tuck. I mean, we know we're not going to Eli for that one. We can pretty much eliminate him, right?
I mean, I love Coughlin's speeches so much. He dropped so many gems in there, and he was inadvertently funny.
I was about to say, a lot of it, and I've had plenty of times where he stands up there and you got to talk to him. It's unintentionally funny sometimes, you know.
When he was up there doing jumping jacks with a torn hamstring for half a year, I was like, dude, just we get it. Nothing's going to stop you. But I also think some of it, he knew we were chuckling and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that was later on in his career where he was taking a little bit of, taking some pages from here and there and trying to relate to players and all that. And it worked. You know, we were out there. He played music one time. I remember he did a drill where he's like, all right, you guys think it's so.
Whoa, he played music. What do you mean?
I remember I was there on the field. It only lasted for like a week because I think we crapped the bed that week. But,
I thought you meant like he was playing music, like Tom Coughlin on the guitar or something. I'm like, what? Wait, hold on a second.
No. That would have been front page. We'd still be talking about that.
Tom Coughlin with the clarinet in front of the team.
But last story, I remember there was something that happened with a punt returner, and he brought us all together. He's like, you guys think it's so easy. He lined everybody up and he would call people out one by one. And, you know, he'd let the punter and you had to field the ball. And I remember he called me out and I was like, you know what? I am not going to criticize a punt returner or a kick returner ever again in my life. That hangs up there. It starts moving left and right. Ever done it, you don't realize how difficult it is. That's something that people have to practice. And I thought that was a good way to make your point. You know, you could talk to us till we're blue in the face, but you put somebody out there, put one of your best players out there and try to get them to do somebody else's job. And you make your point right there. So,
so obviously you're going for TC. He has the most experience with speeches. I figured he would be that answer. Who's teaching your kids, TC, Eli, or Justin Tuck?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, this one, I'll probably go with Eli. We'll round it out. I think
Eli's got a lot of kids now too.
He's got experience. He's got experience. He's a family man. I think his temperament is right for teaching kids. You know, I have to ground myself or remind myself like they're just 6 and 8. They're not, you know, like
you don't have to tell me. I got a 9-year-old girl and a 1-year-old. When you're on that sideline, you gotta pull yourself in sometimes.
You're in it. Yeah. Daddy needs a break. It's free play.
Media training. Who are you going to? TC, Eli, or Tuck? Tuck was great with the media. Eli, though, man, you can't shake him. TC, he can poke him back.
I just saw the other commercial Eli just did. Eli's more, it's got to be more planned out, methodical. I think off the cuff, you got to go with Tuck. Coughlin is more, you know, streamlined. You know, you're going to get what you're going to get. Eli,
you could poke Tom though. You can really get him going.
If you
ask him the question once, he has a, you know, nice calm answer. Yep. Second time, that blood pressure is rising a little bit.
Yeah.
third time, he's finally like, what? You want to tell me he's not playing? Want me to tell you he's not playing? Fine, he's not playing.
Well, that's where it stopped for you. For us, we still had to hear that. Then we keep in the room, and he's like, yeah, and the media is talking about this. They're doing that. They're saying this. I was like, you know, you might want to let that go. Not everything is bulletin board. But you know, it is what it is.
All right. So last one. Ready? Who are you going for relationship advice? TC, Eli, or Tuck?
Oh, none of the above. How about I'm going to go find a nice Zen yoga instructor to give me some advice on calming down that way.
There you go. Yeah. Matthias Kiwanuka, who, by the way, is the CEO of Wandering Wines, which sounds very interesting. Tell me a little about your wine business. I mean, and how do you get into the wine business post-playing career?
Opportunities present themselves, and I like to have a number of projects going at one time, but this was a passion, traveling around the world already and enjoying wine with close personal friends. I think for me, anytime I'm with somebody and they're a master at their craft, whether that's football or if it's wine or if it's, you know, athletics in general, whatever it is, when somebody sits there and they talk for 30, 45 minutes and then they look back and they say, oh, I'm sorry. You know, like, I'm like, no, don't apologize. Like that is valuable to me at this point. That's where you're learning the most. And I got that from a lot of winemakers. There's just this attention to detail and this passion and love for their craft. I think it drew me in as a former athlete, listening to somebody, multiple people talk that passionately about it. And then, you know,
were you a wine connoisseur? Were you big into wines beforehand though?
Not so much. I was getting into it. I would be honest, I couldn't afford it before I started playing. So, so I was getting into it as I was playing. And it just became a point of, instead of, going out and, drinking tequila or doing that kind of stuff, I'd rather just sit, in a quiet environment and have a conversation with a smaller group of people and enjoy some wine. And this opportunity came along and, I ran with it. And lo and behold, it's been, almost a decade, and we travel around the world. We sample wine, we bring it in, and we distribute ourselves down here in South Florida. So everywhere from Key Largo to Jensen Beach, if you come down, Capital Grill down here in Boca is one of our customers. We can sit down, have a steak and a glass of wine and talk
deal.
More.
Deal. You got me sold. I'm down there. I'll be there.
Good.
Okay. Give me a description of, Wandering Wines. Like, do you guys specialize in, what is it? Oaky or like, I don't know. What are some of the adjectives that they use for wines?
There's a ton of different things. I say, if you like it, drink it, as long as it's a decent quality and it's not going to make you, have any adverse effects. But we have something for everybody. So we have, some entry-level wines. We have about 20 to 22 different wines.
And oh, really? Wow.
We continue to add wines every year. So we just added some Italian wines. We have some nice California wines that we had brought in for the Super Bowl that was down here last. And they're doing pretty well. So whatever it is that you're into, I have a bottle of wine that can fit your taste. And, we can sit and chop it up and talk about the differences or talk about life. For me, that's the most important thing, is at the bottom of the bottle that you share, there's some kind of experience. You gain something from sitting with those people and enjoying that bottle of wine. And that's, for me, is more important than what's actually in the bottle.
See, it has like a very good post playing career vibe to it. Wine, because it's very Zen type.
Don't get it twisted. Being in business for yourself is a beast. Especially when you're used to having such structure. To have those wheels, the reins kind of released all at once. You got to structure yourself. You got to do everything for yourself. I was fortunate, my business partners were already in business, other successful businesses. So I was able to adopt that structure and to apply it to this business. But there's a learning curve. I love it. I wanted to do something outside of football for a number of different reasons. And I was able to achieve that. And so this was, it has been a good second career for me.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's the beauty of it. It keeps that blood flowing, right? For you, gets that blood pumping in the business. Keeps your mind fresh and keeps you healthy, mentally I'm talking about. So, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us. That was a great conversation. Matthias Kiwanuka, check out his Wandering Wines. Give us a place where people could find Wandering Wines.
We're on premise down here in South Florida. You can go on wanderingwines.com and you can look at our store locator. It hasn't been updated, but we focus primarily on restaurants up and down the coast. So, like I said, Capital Grill is probably the biggest name that we have, but any restaurant, Fort Lauderdale, Jensen Beach, West Palm Beach, a lot of the restaurants go in there and request it, and we'll get it delivered.
Sounds good, man. I will take you up on that offer. Appreciate it. Matthias Kiwanuka.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business. No matter what stage you're in, shopify.com/network.
Hi, it's Mike Greenberg letting you know ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sportsbook of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me, plus many more. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today. New users get a bet reset up to $1,000 in bonus bets if your first bet doesn't win. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
I really enjoyed that interview a lot. That game was a lot of fun. We'll try and do some more games like that, especially moving on here in the offseason, where we'll have some fun with guys. And also, I want to get some interesting outside the box kind of interview subjects as we move along in the offseason. The offseason is an opportunity to really think outside the box. And since this episode is kind of long, we'll wrap it up pretty quickly here. What I want to do is give you a quick Jordan on the beat. Something Matthias said kind of stuck with me, and then we'll wrap it up. So Jordan on the beat is the part of this podcast where I explain to you what it's like to cover the Giants, work for ESPN, cover the NFL in general. And I'm going to tell you, he mentioned something about how because they did it in 2007, right, they were kind of dead and buried at one point, and people thought they couldn't put it together, and then they did. You know, they started 0-2 that year, if I remember correctly. So, and they were able to turn it around, get their act together, eventually go on, win the Super Bowl, beat the undefeated Patriots. We all know the story. Now, again, in 2011, they're struggling late in the year. They win the last two games. They make the playoffs. They go on this great run. They win the Super Bowl. So it created an atmosphere. So I come in 2013. So that's 2 years later, middle of the season. The season was basically over at that point. They were 0-6. Okay, that season was over. So 14, 15, 16, 17. Every year, because they had done that, and Matthias said that worked to their benefit, because they had done it in the past and they had overcome early season slow starts. But then as they're moving forward, the team's changing. Team's nowhere near as good. They're not replacing all these, you know, really, really good players, and they don't have like the OCU Manuras. Justin Tuck is eventually gone. They don't have the pass rusher. You know, they're losing guys left and right. Eli's getting older. His offensive line had, that was really the last run in 2011. So by 2014, 2015, they start 0-2 every year. And the call from the fans and the media too, the people that had been there forever, was always like, they start 0-2. Well, they did start at 0-2 in 2007. We're able to turn around. And I kept thinking to myself, that was just like the default, like, line of thinking for everybody every time they sucked early in the season. Like, oh, we stink. Well, they stunk early in 2007, so they could do it again. No, by 14, 15, 16, they had a good year. But 17, no, these weren't those teams. It didn't matter if they started 0-2. They weren't going to turn it around. They weren't going to win the Super Bowl. They were nowhere near good enough. They didn't have all those great players that they had in the past. The great younger Justin Tuck wasn't there anymore. O.C. Urmanura wasn't there anymore. Michael Strahan wasn't there anymore. Their all those offensive linemen, they were all gone. Snee left in what, 13, 14, somewhere around 14, I believe it was. 14, 15, whatever it was. So those teams were gone. Yes, you could do it. Like, they were a good team from, like, what? Eli was drafted in 2004. So they were decent in four. So from, like, 2005 to 2012, they were at the very worst an average team, right? I think in 12, what'd they go? 8-8, 9-7. They might have even got 9-7. So from that point, they were always good, pretty good. They weren't a bad team at that point. Once they started dipping down, it wasn't just going to magically spike back up because they weren't good. But that was always the default way of thinking. So it's kind of interesting when you hear Kiwanuka say that, because that paid dividends in 11 when they were basically dead and buried because they had done it in 7. But because they did it in 7-11, didn't mean they were going to do it in 13. Didn't mean they were going to do it in 14. Didn't mean they were going to do it in 15, 17, 18, 19, 20. I mean, those days are gone. Now we're about a decade removed, which is kind of crazy, from the Giants' last Super Bowl season. It's getting further and further away right now. This organization obviously is in a way, way different position. So we're going to wrap it up there. I'm taking the Chiefs in the Super Bowl. You know why? I don't bet against Patrick Mahomes. Nope, nope, nope. I know Tom Brady's on the other side. You tell me this is a 28-year-old Tom Brady, 32-year-old Tom Brady, 34-year-old Tom Brady, 43-year-old Tom Brady is still pretty darn good. But he's not the best quarterback in the league. He's not playing at the level he did in 2007 when he was pretty much at the top of – when I believe that was his best season, in my opinion, when he was at the top of his game. So give me the best quarterback. Patrick Mahomes, even though I believe the overall roster on the Bucs is better, 33-31 Chiefs. And with that, that's the end of this episode of Breaking Big Blue. As always, feel free to provide me feedback, comments, Facebook, Instagram, email, Twitter, TikTok. You can find me all those places. I'm your host, Jordan Ronan, ESPN, ESPN.com, Giants reporter. See you next time.